Our meeting will come to order, please.
That's John.
Right, we're coming to order.
And Bill, continue tonight if necessary in what room this room.
Good morning, everyone. Today we have two bills before us. House File 2025 and House File 2596. Absolutely different kinds of bills. So we should have an interesting discussion this morning. And if need be, we will resume tonight in this room at 5 or 6. I guess at five, because I have another meeting tonight that I'd like to get to. So at 5 o'clock, we'll resume if we need to. And let's see who can I get.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of the last meeting.
Representative McFarland moves the minutes from March 1st. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 1st are approved. The legislative assistant will note the roll, and we have a new legislative assistant. Her name is Kate Hemsing. We've done just a little moving in the education arena. And Melissa Hackenmuller, who used to sit to my left, now is our research person. So we welcome Melissa to that position and Kate to her position. And I'm delighted to have both of them with us. With that, Representative Erdahl, welcome to our committee. You're a great education reformer, and we're glad to have you in the hot seat today. Members, I will move House File 2025 to be before us, and Representative Erdahl, you have a delete everything amendment. So, members, I will move the H2025DE4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the bill is now in the order that Representative Erdahl would like it. And members, the motion will be to move this to the Committee on K-12 Finance. So with that said, Representative Erdahl, will you explain House File 2025 as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, always good to be before the Education Committee. I've served on this for, I think, 4 or 6 years, I don't remember which, but enjoyed my time with education as a former educator. House File 2025, several provisions here from the original bill. There are some that have been removed. Expressly the PSCO 9th and 10th grade provisions. It includes intermediate school districts within the definition of eligible institutions. It allows PSEO students to enroll in non-sectarian academic, career, and technical courses. It allows post-secondary institutions the ability to advertise. It allows partnerships between businesses and academic institutions, essentially a type of internship. It requires pupils to designate whether a course is for secondary or post-secondary credit. And creates a task force working on how to best integrate career and vocational education into K-12 education. The world is changing, and education must adapt. We need to model ourselves after the best in the world, our country, and our state, and to provide more opportunities for our students. Vocational career education has changed. In some ways, we are not meeting the needs. And the governor's job summit this fall, businesses highlighted the need for vocational and career jobs like welders, basically saying that there's a crying need in this state for more of those types of occupations. And so we need to look at models that can help us to move in that direction. I went through the Anoka STEP program earlier this fall and looked at how they were operating, how they did the concurrent education there. The purpose of this is to bring stakeholders together, this task force, to find answers and how we can take some of the best from various areas and put them together here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, and I believe you have some testifiers. So we will begin with Joe Nathan. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change. Since 1970, I have been an aide, public school teacher, administrator, researcher, PTA president, member of the state PTA board, and other roles. We have provided testimony in this and 20 other, invited testimony in this and 20 other states and several congressional committees. I'm speaking today for myself alone, not representing any institution. I want to thank the representative for introducing this legislation and the co-authors. There are some significant steps forward here, and there are some areas that I hope that the committee and legislators will continue to review as the bill goes through the process. And as the chief author pointed out this morning, that this is a process, and it's open to a variety of influences and a variety of suggestions. And as a former history teacher, I completely respect and appreciate the importance of a process where different people have an opportunity to provide input. So a very brief historical note. 26 years ago, this legislature had a huge debate about whether education funding was for the preservation of a particular system or first and foremost for the education of young people. And the legislature decided on a bipartisan basis, both Republicans and Democrats, some of whom are in this room, that first and foremost, within some limits, and those limits are important, within some limits, the legislature provides education, provides funds for the education of young people. So, for example, beginning in 1985, we began allowing high schools to offer courses. Actually, before 1985, high schools had been allowed to offer courses that earned post-secondary credit, advanced placement, for example, or college in the schools. The legislature also decided that it would be possible for 11th and 12th graders to take colleges and university courses on college campuses. There was a huge hubbub. One of the major education groups in this state told Education Week, a national publication, that was the worst piece of legislation that had passed in a quarter century. Materials were circulated. Legislators were told if they voted for this, certain things might happen to them. But the legislature, on a bipartisan basis, decided to move ahead. More than 110,000 youngsters have participated. The results have been very positive, both for the youngsters. More than 90% of the youngsters participating in post-secondary options have said that they would do it over again. Equally important is in what about the youngsters who are, quote, left behind, a key and important argument that was made 25 years ago. Well, what we saw was, much to the credit of K through 12 educators throughout the state, that high schools established new advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools, and other courses. Indeed, in 1996, the legislative auditor did a major study, and one of the major conclusions was that although many secondary school principals did not like post-secondary options, preferred that the youngsters stay in the school, more than half of the high school principals said that one of the results of post-secondary options was that it increased collaboration, increased communication between high schools and colleges, a good thing. And so in many, many respects, post-secondary options has not been a panacea, but it has been progress. So what does the current bill provide with modifications? First, it removes a provision, a somewhat strange provision in this country of free speech. It removes a provision that says that colleges and universities can't do what high schools are doing, which is to say, tell the truth. It removes the provision that says that colleges and universities can't tell families that if they participate in post-secondary options, if the youngsters do well, they save money. Fairly basic. But some years ago, that was put in by some people who didn't want colleges and universities to do that. This bill, with your help, would remove that prohibition. We call it the truth in advertising provision. Secondly, and that's an important step forward. Secondly, it removes a provision also put in some years ago, sort of a mischief provision that says that although youngsters in taking advanced placement and international baccalaureate in college and schools can earn both high school and college credit, Youngsters participating in PSEO have to make a choice, a somewhat strange thing really put in there just to sort of be a little mischievy, and this, again, removes that provision. Third, this provision, this bill does say that we're going to continues the progress in those two ways. However, we are going to suggest a series of people from the African American Leadership Forum, from the Minnesota Council of Gifted and Talented, from the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, and others. We're going to suggest that there are a couple of things that we hope the legislature, in its wisdom, will continue as it continues to make progress. These are not just our recommendations, by the way. In the material that was recently distributed just a few minutes ago, you'll see that the Star Tribune endorsed these ideas, as did the ECM newspapers, a group of suburban and greater Minnesota newspapers, and that's in your packet. They endorsed the things that I'm going to talk about briefly right now. First, they endorsed the idea of allowing 9th and 10th graders to take one course. Now, some have suggested that we open this up to all 9th and 10th graders. We thought, and the Star Tribune and the ECM newspapers agreed, that it made more sense to allow 9th and 10th graders to take one course on a basis to see if they were ready. It seems to us that it would not be appropriate to say 9th and 10th graders, you're ready to take as many courses as you want. So we wanted them to give an incentive, but we also understood that there are some youngsters who are not doing especially well in high school who could do very well in college. That's not just our opinion. If you look at this handout in the center, it looks at studies about thousands and thousands of youngsters who participated in dual enrollment courses around the country. And this was research done at the University of Minnesota, indicating that contrary to the arguments of some critics of expanding dual enrollment programs, dual enrollment can benefit a range of students, not only those who achieve at very high levels in high school. Indeed, dual enrollment may be the most beneficial to those students who are often excluded from participation. Thus, it seems to me that there are a number of important and valuable provisions in this bill, but that we hope as the process moves ahead you will consider two other provisions. One that allows 9th and 10th graders to take one course, and if they do well, to take more. And secondly, that allows 11th and 12th graders, even if they don't meet the grade point average or the class rank averages currently established by the Minnesota State College and University systems, to try one course, and if they do well, to continue to be able to take those courses. So we have a series of other people, and I thank the representative and the authors of the legislature for your time, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan.
Paul?
I think you have others, don't you, who you want to call up? Welcome to our committee, sir.
Hey,
please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Paul Menny, and I wish you would have brought more rolls. That would have been fantastic. anyway, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My purpose here today is just to share my experience with PSEO with you. And so that is what I'll do. It won't take too long. Basically, my experience with PSEO is that I was not allowed to do it. I was a number. I was 51%. I was the first high school senior in my class in the bottom half. So right there in the middle, but the first one on the bottom half. And as a result of that, I wasn't allowed to do it. You know, being a white kid from a middle-class family whose parents came to the school and advocated for me to do so wasn't enough for me to get over that hump either. Also not enough for me to get over that hump was 3 days prior to that meeting with the school to try and do PSEO, I had just graduated from basic training. I had signed up as a 17-year-old high schooler, went to basic training between my 11th and 12th grade year, for a number of reasons, to serve my country and my state, but also to fund my college education. And so, but this was still, again, not enough for me to allow myself to take PSEO. So after not being allowed to do it, I did go on and I graduated. I went from my high school graduation to the United States Intelligence Center in Arizona. Studied the course there to become an intelligence analyst. I graduated second in my class of 60, of which half didn't even finish. So I was an honor graduate as an intelligence analyst for the Guard here. And then I went to Minnesota State University in Mankato, achieved multiple Dean's List honors, and graduated with honors as a finance graduate. So I did pretty well considering I wasn't allowed to do PSEO. And if that was enough, wouldn't be enough, you know, I've got some more for you. After that, I was a highly motivated individual, and some would say citizen soldier at that point. I became vice president of a community bank by the age of 27 as well. So, but again, obviously there was a process that failed me, and I'm okay with that. The reason I'm here today is because I'm a father of five kids, and that's what I'm most proud of. And it's my kids, and then the kids, all the other kids who just arrived at school this morning, they have no idea we're talking about this. This is going to affect them and their opportunities, and at the end of the day, they're going to have bigger problems to solve than I have, and then that everyone else in this room has. And I really feel they need to have more options and be better prepared, and we need to give them every opportunity to do so. And that's what I was here for, just to advocate for that. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Would you spell your last name for us?
M-E-N-N-E.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And then next we have, welcome to our committee, sir, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Tony Simmons. I'm the program director at High School for Recording Arts in St. Paul. And High School for Recording Arts is a independent public charter school, and we serve about 80% African American students, about 60% male. And I've also been asked today to speak on behalf of the African American Leadership Forum. The African American Leadership Forum is a group of 650 people from various jobs and responsibilities throughout Minnesota. An important part of the African American Leadership Forum's legislative agenda is to promote equity via post-secondary options, expand access for PSEO to the ninth grade, adjust current PSEO rules to allow colleges to tell students and families that by participating, they can save literally thousands of dollars, and to remove barriers that prevent low-income and students of color from dual enrollment. But speaking on behalf of myself as a program director of a school, a high school, where most of my students come from families who never attended college, I can say to you from experience that creating a college-going culture by use of PSEO makes a huge difference in terms of my role as a school director. We believe that traditionally African-American students have been underrepresented among 2 and 4 year graduates, and there are many reasons for this. Research by the Center for School Change and others show that participating in various forms of dual enrollment, including PSEO, can help increase the number of students who not only enter but graduate from some form of higher education. And I have personally seen that with my students who have enrolled in PSEO, who have been able to be more successful not only as high school students, but also once they graduate in college. As a person who works daily with African American and low-income students, I've seen the value of PSEO, as I've said. I've also seen the value of giving young people and others who think that they have low skills and little promise opportunities. So in conclusion, allowing colleges to tell families the truth about saving money via PSEO is a good idea. Allowing 9th and 10th graders to try PSEO course is a good idea. And allowing them to continue if they earn a C is a good idea. Allowing 11th and 12th graders to explore a particular interest for one course, regardless of their grade, also is a good idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Simmons. And members, please note that the last two testifiers were addressing something that's not in this particular provision. It is in the Senate provision, I believe, but not in ours. Nevertheless, they are addressing it, and I think that's because they have hope for the future. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hi, I'm Tina Armstrong. I am current president of the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented and the parent of a gifted and talented student. I'm addressing you today about You know, this is actually something we had advocated for a number of years, to open up PSEO to our 9th and 10th graders for GT kids. So I am disappointed in the DE4 amendment, and I've expressed that to the author. And we're committed to working with them as this moves forward and over the years with this. But I do have to say that, you know, we have put into legislation efforts to have every district have acceleration policies so that kids are able to, our gifted and talented students are able to work at their level, and every district now today has to have acceleration policies. So we're going to have more and more kids that are ready for advanced level work at the 9th and 10th grade level. And I'd really like to see that available to them. Colleges and universities already can set limitations of their own on the kids that they're admitting into these programs. So they do things like limit them to one class, or they say, we don't take kids, you know, our school isn't ready to take kids that are younger than a particular age. But really, we'd like to see it as an option for not just those families that can afford to pay for it on their own, but for other kids that are ready for this advanced level work at the 9th and 10th grade level. I myself had it. For my own son, we had to make a tough choice. Did he want to be accelerated during high school? Did he want to do a grade skip in order to get at this college level work at a younger age? And we made the choice of grade skip, and he graduated at 16. So I don't want families to have to make those tough choices. You know, it's not for everyone. It's not a replacement for the wonderful things our high schools are doing as far as AP and IB and other gifted programs and honors programs at the high school level. So it's not for everybody, but I like it to be a choice on the table for families.
Thank you very much, Ms. Armstrong. Are there other testifiers in support of this provision? Please come forward. Welcome to our committee, sir, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Steve Allen. I'm the executive coordinator of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. Thank you for introducing this bill. It's really a great opportunity to come and speak to you again. Kids are changing. Almost 30 years ago, I was here advocating for student and parental choice with the Area Learning Center and PSEO legislation, and you helped that make that happen. Almost 25 years ago, I was here with Bob Wadle, former commissioner, trying to push the independent study legislation through. And again, you made that happen. To this day, some people still don't believe that kids can learn this way, and that the only way to measure learning is via seat time. I'm here today, almost 30 years later, to say you can't believe in choice without believing in choices. In the beginning, many people anticipated the opportunities that the ALC legislation would have on at-risk kids. What you didn't anticipate is the opportunities that PSEO would have on at-risk kids. That surprised people, but it opened up another avenue for our students. In fact, it's one of the few career and technical avenues that's still available to our students. And that's the piece that I'm really advocating for, is to try to keep those career and technical opportunities available for at-risk kids. I remember when PSEO was first introduced, I got called over by my local community college about those darn PSEO kids. They're failing at a terrible rate. And I said to them, what's the rate of your regular freshmen? Guess what? We didn't know. And you know what the success rate has been of PSEO kids. And just look at that data. We all realize that one size doesn't fit all. When I was the director of the Oakland Area Learning Center, we tried to give each member school district in our community different types of options and choices for kids. At our state conference 2 weeks ago, author Kirsten Olson, who wrote Wounded by School, Recapturing Joy in Learning and Standing Up to Old School Culture, talked about kids who struggled within the educational system. She also talked about what it takes to turn around for the healing process to begin. She noted that sometimes kids just need a totally different learning environment to demonstrate success. Many times PSEO provides this opportunity for our students, and they couldn't afford to do it if they had to pay for it, many of them themselves. You know, that it is an economic issue for many of our students. In closing, I would like to talk about one student. This student was one of the most abstract, random kids. He was a right brainer way out there, and he was very artistic, very creative. He would work in the theater. He'd work backstage because he'd build stuff to be involved. He was just a really good kid. Did he meet the traditional academic standards? No. To get into PSEO, but he was with us long enough that I could get him into our 51st percentile. And I said, try one class. One class. I said, any class you want. He took a philosophy class of all classes. And guess what? He got an A. What do you think that did for his self-esteem? Please continue to provide choices and lead as you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen is also one of my former bosses, and I loved working under him in our alternative program, Oakland. Welcome to our committee, sir, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dane Smith. I'm the president of Growth and Justice. We're a policy research and advocacy organization focused on expanding economic prosperity and reducing economic inequality in Minnesota. We are particularly focused on education policy and reducing the unacceptable gaps that have opened up by income and race in educational achievement and attainment. We think these gaps represent the most serious threat to our long-term economic health in Minnesota, but viewed another more positive way, closing these gaps are also our greatest opportunity for business growth, and there is enormous, diverse, untapped human potential to be realized. Although we're disappointed to see elements of this bill removed, we do support it, and any and all further effective policy making that gets this human potential as early as possible on the track to at least some form of post-secondary attainment and skills training beyond high school. It's for this reason we actually support prenatal investment and early childhood education investment as well. Our organization has brought considerable research and resources, including some of the nation's top scholars, rigorous evidence testing, and cost-effectiveness criteria to the study of what really works in this total birth-through-career pipeline. And we strongly embrace the concept of a comprehensive and continuous improvement, a more seamless system in Minnesota that is designed to prepare preschoolers so they're fully ready for kindergarten, boost them right through to higher education with as few institutional barriers as possible. In our comprehensive report on this, we strongly endorse the concept of interventions such as early college high schools that focus on first-generation college hopefuls, low-income English language learners, and minority students. On the segment of the pipeline or the track that we labeled Ready for Higher Learning, we said this: all students benefit from participation in accelerated learning programs such as post-secondary enrollment options, including AP courses and college and schools courses. So PSEO emerged not just as a desirable option, but as one of the most cost-effective interventions that gets that makes that track run all the way through to attainment of post-secondary credentials. And we even urged and recommended that the state invest more money in this, some $95 million in these ninth through post-secondary options. So this nonstop all the way through track is the right principle to pursue, and we are pleased to be helping knock down these barriers that exist between early childhood and K-3 and between 9 through 12 and post-secondary. The parents of these children, many of them are already navigating an unfair economy. They're unfairly challenged in navigating between the train terminal that stops at the end of high school and finding their way across town to a completely separate, different train system that delivers them to the destination they really need. So everything you can do in the future to break down these institutional barriers would encourage you to take. We are aware of some of the opposition to this. We are aware that Menscu and our high school leaders are actually working very hard for reducing these barriers, for integrating high school curriculum. We're working with Inverhill, Century College, Menscu, and others towards this goal of seamlessness and removing the barriers. And I want to commend Chancellor Rosenstone and the Menscu faculty for elevating this obstacle reduction. Please keep at this idea of removing the institutional barriers and getting our kids right through to post-secondary. That's the goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there others? Welcome. Please say your name for the record to begin.
Yes, my name is Bandao Lee. I work for the Center for School Change, and I'm sharing my story, personal story of participating in dual credit. I came to America in 1989. I am a refugee from Thailand. English is my second language. I am a low-income first generation to high school and college. I just want to quickly show you the dynamics of my family so you understand what type of world I'm living in. I have a brother who is part of the Asian Crips gang, one who is part of the Blood gang. No one in my family has gone to college. Being the only one with parents who barely had any education, it was really hard to navigate. But at the same time, I have been very blessed to have worked really hard in my middle school years, 7th to 8th grade, that I transitioned straight into AP my 9th grade year. That provided me 4 years of all AP, and I naturally went into college in the schools. I would have naturally went into PSEO if I didn't have the barrier of being among women and my parents had the transportation for me, but I would have loved if I had that opportunity to go back again and do that, so I could have transitioned better into a college setting. I did go on to, again, I went to Johnson High School on the east side of St. Paul. I graduated from St. Olaf College. The language that I acquired through participating in CIS and AP, my parents do not know what college is. That was really hard, along with the exposure to U of M and knowing kind of how to navigate a little bit, but not as much as I wish I would have had. That opportunity provided me, I'm a hard worker like many of our students you see in the schools. I just need an opportunity, and dual credit was it molded that key for me to go to college. I know one of the reasons why they accepted me at St. Olaf was because I've been taking AP since my 9th grade year. I don't think I would have gotten in if I had not been participating in any of these dual credit programs. The first thing is I really hope that you consider expanding to 9th grade and 10th graders, because I know currently CIS is also on a limited basis allowing 9th graders and 10th graders to be a part of CIS too. And CIS and PSEO, by the way, are only allowed to 11th and 12th graders. So I really hope that you will expand PSEO that way, in the same way. I don't want us to forget about the special ed students who could be benefiting from these classes too. And then the last part I do want to include, and it comes from my work working in the schools and then working at the center, is the knowledge that we're sharing with our parents. If there is any way we can help bring the knowledge, whether it's AP, IB, College in the Schools, or PSEO, most importantly PSEO, because the frustration sometimes is always PSEO. That's the one that's often missed. And my work with all the parents of different backgrounds, different income status, is why aren't either they have to navigate themselves or they just don't know, or they don't know how to navigate the system. And so my push is if we can pass the if higher education can help us promote PSEO, can save students time and money like myself, what I went through, that would be very helpful. And so I really hope you consider those two bills to be passed.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Great to have you here today. We have others. I believe the chamber. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Director of Education and Workforce Development Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports expanded PSEO for many of the reasons that have already been testified to. So I'll just add quickly that PSEO encourages interest in STEM and manufacturing related fields. While more students are going into STEM fields, demand still continues to exceed supply and will continue to do so. PSEO enables students to take advanced math and science courses early, and then students go on to STEM careers. But it's also very important to encourage early interest in career and tech fields, because we have a real need to increase the worker supply for the manufacturing sector. So I just wanted to thank Representative Erdahl for this legislation. And
thank you very much. And I think our last testifier in support, yes. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And you've heard a lot of wonderful testimony and reasons why this is a great bill. I'll just emphasize the fact that anything the state can do to help students transition from K-12 to higher ed is especially important, especially given the trends where 70% of all new jobs will require some post-secondary education within the next 5 years or so. We think this bill, and if it gets amended as well for 9th and 10th, but as it stands, this bill is a great step forward, and I would encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then I think we have those with concerns. School Boards Association first. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Stein. I went on staff of the School Boards Association. I wouldn't characterize them as concerns. I think we embrace the concept of promoting and advancing our high school students and giving them post-secondary opportunities. I think perhaps when this was initiated, I think our association would have been on the other side of this saying, wait a second here, what's happening? But I think whenever this opportunity comes before our association, we understand the benefits of PSEO and what it means for students and school districts and their families. And so we understand the importance of that. I think the one issue, and I understand this is the policy committee, the one issue that I think that does raise some concern for us is the issue of advertising. And I think that that as a policy committee, you need to determine whether under current law that requires school districts to inform the families and parents in sub 6 and sub 7 about the positives and negatives of going into PSEO. I think the other issue is that school districts are required to meet with all 8th through 11th graders to share what PSEO means to them, what opportunities are available to them. So then taking off the advertising requirement, so that's the policy discussion you're going to have is are you going to require schools to do it, or do you remove that requirement and just open the free market and let the post-secondary institutions mail directly to the students about the advantages of PSEO opportunities? So I think those are the issues that we're concerned about.
Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwind. Are there others who might have a particular issue to address? Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Roger Ernst, and I represent the elementary and secondary principal organizations. And we met with Representative Erdahl and talked about this, and I have to say that we look forward to working with him on the task force here. I think that there, in visiting with our folks, there are an awful lot of exciting current technical programs that are in high schools out there, and the expansion of that is a good thing. And we look forward to working with them, and we appreciate how the bill was restructured. One thing, we've had some conversations back and forth about some language that's being deleted in Section 5 in the credits section. And we just would say that you need to look at that closely. One of the things that's right here, 3.4, and I don't know if this is a concern or not. We've talked to the department about it a little bit, and we're a little bit uncertain about that. So as we go through, we may talk about that a little bit more. Conceptually, the way that the PSEO works, you have questions of enrollment, and then you have questions of credit. And you can't be enrolled more than 1.0 FDE, so to speak. So you can't dually enroll full-time in college and full-time in high school, but you can end up with credit for both of them. And this is deleting the enrollment part of that. And so it may be a concern, it may not be, but that's something I think you want to look at, and we can talk about that as this goes along. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there others we'd like to express concerns? Seeing none, I would like to recognize our pages who are in the audience. Would you please stand? These are our student pages. Welcome to our committee. I wish I had time to let you introduce yourselves, but we'll meet you on the floor as you help us this week. Thank you very much for being here. With that, members, we'll go on to questions. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. Representative Erdahl, I've actually asked my staff to get me signed on to your bill. So I do like your bill. I do support it. I actually like the move toward the 9th and 10th. I understand that's not here at this point, but we'll have ongoing good debate about that, no doubt. Excuse me. I also understand that in the Senate bill, I know we're not debating the Senate bill, but apparently there's language there that would open up a number of areas and a number of elements of the PSEO program. And so I guess I don't so much have a question at this point as much as just, you know, want a statement of support for the bill, but also to express concern to you about the Senate language in the event that your bill moves successfully forward, which I suspect it will, and the Senate does too, that before we do PSEO opening up for for-profit proprietary institutions, I think we need to have a very careful conversation. And believe me, I know a number of these institutions and greatly appreciate what they do and the quality of their work. But I also know a number of them who are the opposite in terms of the quality of the work and what they do. And this is sort of an emerging policy issue, both at the national and local level, in terms of public funds flowing to these institutions with pretty minimal accountability. And in some cases, some pretty horrible stories of how students have been preyed upon in terms of finances and promises of academic success. And clearly, PSEO will be a little bit different because we're not pulling money out of students' pockets to pay for that. But I would want us to be very careful about the state's interaction with this community of schools until we much more carefully talk through, you know, that sector's behavior and outcomes with students. And so, Madam Chair, I apologize, it's not directly on point with the language before us, but I thought, you know, at a public hearing, it would be good to get it on the record that that would be a major concern of mine, understanding that the Senate bill is moving in that direction.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani. Yes, the Senate is at present moving along in that direction. I'm sure we'll have a very interesting conversation with the Senate as we go along. For those who may not be aware, encapsulating what the Senate is looking at, basically the Minsky Institution gets the right of first refusal if a 9th or 10th grader applies under PSEO. If they turn them down, then they, under the Senate proposal, could go to a for-profit institution like a Rasmussen or something like that.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for clarifying that. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, I obviously am a co-author of your bill. I strongly support it. I find it interesting that we have somewhat of the same lineups of people as we had, you know, 30 years ago or 25 years ago in support and with concerns about this bill. And thankfully, we've come such a long ways that that the opposition has toned down. My question, even though I am a co-author of the bill, I have no idea why we took out the 9th and 10th graders. That was, to me, in addition to getting out some of the impediments that you still have in your bill, having the opportunity for 9th and 10th graders, I thought was the most exciting part of the bill. And obviously there's a big couple of chapters in this story that took place behind closed doors. I don't know what those chapters are, and I now would like to hear them. Who didn't want the 9th and 10th graders, and what were their reasons?
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greiling. I will presently invite down, you know, one or two of the objectors. But, you know, basically, as you know, we have a process. and we chose the route in the House to go one way, and we, with the knowledge that the Senate is going a little bit different direction, as I just explained, and we'll see where the process takes us as we go through. So, shall we?
Representative Rudolph, we'd like to bring down an objector or two that will answer Representative Freiling's question.
Objectors or two can line up. would Minskew like to make a comment? Mr. Oman?
Members, all you could say about this committee is we get right down to business, don't we? Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bernie Oman at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and Representative Greiling. The conversations that we've had both in the Senate and the House with Senator Olson and Representative Erdahl was not based on the ninth or tenth graders. It was based on criteria for entering into the PSEO that we wanted to maintain the opportunity to set criteria for enrollment and academic achievement to make sure that the students were successful once they came inside of the PSEO. But the ninth and tenth graders was really not part of it. It was a bigger conversation about who can enter into the PSEO academically.
Representative Greiling, do you have a follow-up to that?
Well, okay, thank you, Madam Chair. This doesn't answer any of my questions then. He's obviously off point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rudolph.
Representative Greiling, Mr. Ullman is correct in what he said as to Minskew being concerned about the who is setting the criteria for admission into their schools. But as I recall, there were a few more specific things about ninth and tenth graders that were discussed, and I don't know if it was just with Mr. Ullman or other Minskew folks, but some of the concerns involved the readiness of ninth graders, even in vocational classes, for example, an automotive class. The reading level is on a 13th, 14th year. These are technical manuals that they're going through, and so and also the math level. There's no remedial courses that these students would be offered, so they're going to be going from ninth grade right into a college level reading level and a college level math level. So those were some of the concerns that were brought by people with Minskew.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for filling in some of the blanks. So in other words, it was higher ed who didn't want ninth and tenth graders. It wasn't the K-12 system worrying about losing students walking out the door with their per pupils.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Greiling, I will say most of the concerns that I heard came from Minskew, but there were some also from the high schools, the secondary schools as well. And if they want to fill in a little bit, they can do that as well.
Madam Chair, if I could...
Mr. Ullman, please go ahead.
Try to address Representative Greiling's question. When we had conversations both in the Senate and the House, it was based on the criteria of getting. We do not object to the language that is in the Senate bill.
Representative Erdahl, do you have others?
I think Mr. Aronson is coming down again.
Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Aronson,
secondary principals had concerns about ninth and tenth graders. I think part of the high schools don't set any enrollment criteria for this. Minskew does, and it's a program that was created for juniors and seniors. If you're in the and the criteria that Minskew sets is if you're in the top half of your senior class or the top third of your junior class, you can go into this program. Just as a functional matter, there was some concerns about how would you make those decisions with regard to ninth and tenth graders. because we don't have those class ranks, and they're quite a bit different when they come out. That was one issue. I think there was a concern, and this is why we like the fix that Representative Erdahl did with this. As the discussion focused into career and technical, because that's what this bill was about, it seemed to be that there was a lack of information as to what career and technical was taking place in Minnesota schools, and that we do the PSEO-type programs where kids are getting refrigeration certificates, they're getting electrical certificates. Several schools have spent a lot of money on infrastructure pieces on career and technical. Alexandria is building a new school. They went and toured St. Francis to see what their current, and so you need to know those things before you change the rules on the enrollment on this stuff, and how can you replicate those programs. And we have said to the author, and we said this in the Senate as well, that college in the schools has been a very successful program that came as the result of the PSEO program, and to the extent that we can start to model a career in technical in the same vein as college in the schools, we think that might be a very successful program with some money in it, and we think the task force is going to move this that way. So those were some of the things that we talked about. That's why the bill interested us in this form.
Representative Greiling, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Arnson, you know, these are, I think having college in the schools is a very fine program, and having AP and IB and all the things that have crept up that had they been there, maybe PSEO wouldn't have passed in the first place. It was the concern that they weren't there that was a catalyst, as I recall clearly, for the legislation in the first place. The last meeting I was at, and the only one I was at with the chapters that I'm missing here, I thought it was settled that ninth graders, you know, to be determined in the top percent of their class, or, you know, some sort of cut that wouldn't just be all ninth and tenth graders, at least initially, was something that was be settled on. But that the principals didn't even support that.
You know, Representative Greiling, I know Mr. Arnson was not at the meeting that we discussed this. So, Mr. Arnson, if you'd like to venture a guess.
I really don't.
Okay. Representative Greiling.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Arnson, then would that, as this bill goes forward, would that be something that principals would be open to if there was some sort of screening of the ninth and tenth graders to where they could take one class, and then if they're successful, they go forward?
Mr. Arnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, the school principals did not support a broad opening of PSEO to ninth and tenth graders. You talk about a narrow opening. I think people would want to look at what we currently do and how you could manage that and how it made sense. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, as we always say, the devil's would be in the details. I do think we should be careful. You know, I think everybody appreciates care with moving forward with this program.
And then, thank you, Madam Chair. My final question then, Mr. Arnson. Your objections seem to me, and I could be characterizing them wrong, but just listening to you from what you said, seem to be monetary for the school being able to, the regular school, still maintain programs that they've spent a lot of money developing for students, and then if those students end up making a PSEO choice instead, is that more your concern, or is your concern more the student being able to succeed?
Mr. Arnson, tough question.
Madam Chair, first of all, I thought it was, I wouldn't characterize us as objectors at this particular stage. And I think that there's a lot of exciting things that happen in this area. And a couple years ago, there was some changes or discussion about restricting colleges in the schools and some different requirements that would go on the teachers on that. The principals got very disturbed about any restrictions on college in the schools and how that works. We need money to help support that program. That's a different committee, but that's always part of the deal. And we think we need money to support the career technical piece as well, and view this as a very nice step into doing that. And there's some other exciting ideas about this. So we think this is going to be good in the long term. We really do. So, I think we're doing pretty well, actually, in a positive sort of fashion. I think there's a struggle to find a fight on this, and I don't think we have one.
Representative Norton. Thank you, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the discussion we're having right now is key to this component of the 9th to 10th grade, and I respectfully disagree a little bit with Representative Greiling on this. I think the discussion we're having now is a discussion that needs to continue and that we don't leap forward and do something without these types of discussion. We have been working for some time making certain that our students graduate able to read and do math. And now we're talking about perhaps moving students ahead who don't have the college level math and reading into a program where they could conceivably have some success with support in the area of a tech degree and still not be able to do read and math if we're not careful. I mean, we can't put the cart before the horse. So I think the discussion we're having here and that Roger Aronson was talking about is one that needs to be in-depth and not done quickly. So I appreciate Representative Erdahl removing this and putting the task force in, and we move ahead very cautiously in this area. And I think the college and the schools, the AP and the IB, have been huge for our students. Having just sent a student to college at the age of 17 with a 36 on his ACT and an honor student, only to have him come home because he was not prepared, despite his intelligence, for what happens at college, that happens. We have PSEO students who go at 10th or 11th grade to PSEO only to find out that in failing a course they also jeopardize their own high school graduation. That's a real issue for our students. By moving this up further, I guess on the one hand you could say they have more time now to catch up on their courses, but once you get behind in a high school setting, it is very difficult to catch back up with the number of credits that you need to graduate on time. So I'm going to encourage us to slow down on the 9th through 10th. I think we can move in that direction, but we need to do so thoughtfully. The other piece I just want to touch on, and I'm sorry I'm going on so long, but we haven't talked about how to keep our students successful as we move them forward in PSEO, and one of the ways you do that is by excellent counseling and careful choices about who gets in the program. I know our colleges in our area struggle with having appropriate counseling, not only for their own college students, but then to take on the enrollment of PSEO to make certain that the students are staying on task, that they don't flunk a course and end up jeopardizing graduation. This is already occurring. And we have cut down on the number of high school counselors, and we know that's an issue in our state already. So the whole issue of student counseling and the need at the high school and at the college level in order to assure that a growing number of PSEO students is successful, I think is key to the discussion as we move ahead. So I am supportive of Representative Erdahl's bill in its current form. I would be very cautious about putting my name on it only because I know what's happening in the Senate and what I'm hearing in discussion that we might, in my mind, wrongfully move ahead too quickly. I think we're moving at the right speed right now and having the right discussions. And thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of following up with Representative Norton, I'm very familiar with PSEO. My daughter did it. And there is something to be considered when you're sending a kid that's in 9th grade to college. They're hanging out with older people, and it's different, you know, socially. So I do support your version, and at least at this point. And then I also have to question, you know, I'd like to actually hear from Parents United what parents think about this sending 9th and 10th graders into college. And then when we start to get into that, they're younger, they can't drive, so do we have transportation issues? Do we have liability issues? And if so, are there fiscal notes attached? Thank you.
Representative Kiefer, this bill is going to finance.
Okay, thanks.
Are there others who would like to speak in support or with concerns? Well, I see no other questions from members and no one from the audience coming forward. So with that, Representative Erdahl, I will move House File 2025 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way to K-12 Finance. Thank you very much, Representative Erdahl. Yes. And thank you to all of those who testified. You were just excellent in your presentations.
Thank you, members.
Representative Depke.
I waved at you. Did you see me move all the way? Oh, no, no. I mean, you're all right, but I wouldn't just wave at you.
Representative Depke, would you like to move your bill? And I believe you should refer it to the Committee on K-12 Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd be happy to. I'd like to move House File 2596 regarding the Minnesota Department of Education rulemaking clarified, and we will. I'd like to have it pass and move on to K-12 Finance.
Thank you, Representative Depke. Moves 2596 recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Representative Depke, please explain your bill.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. House File 2596, as I mentioned in the title, is rulemaking clarified. This bill is about clarification of the rule process and the role of the Minnesota Department of Education in that process already in statute. This is not changing statute and the rulemaking process in any way or current legislation. House File 2596 amends statutes to 2010, Section 127A or Subdivision 4, entitled Administrative Rules, by adding an A and B section to current statute as follows. And if you'll take a look at the bill that's in your folder, you can follow along with me. A reinstates current language of the law governing rules by the Education Commissioner. Number one, it states the context of the guidelines. Number two, the criteria of the rulemaking, bulletins, and other pronouncements that the commissioner might issue. This particular piece of law also declares, as currently in statute, that any pronouncements by the commissioner intended to be treated as rules must be adopted as rules, or they are unenforceable. This is already in current law. Section B reinforces Minnesota current statutes, Chapter 14, which outlines procedures all state agencies, I'd like to emphasize, must follow when they adopt administrative rules by adding the following language. Number one, it prohibits the commissioner from enforcing pronouncements to school districts that meet the definition of a rule but have not been adopted as rules. Number two, it requires the commissioner to notify districts when issuing such pronouncements that the pronouncements are not enforceable. And finally, number three, it allows school districts to petition the Office of Administrative Hearings seeking an order for an administrative law judgment determining that the commissioner is enforcing or attempting to enforce a pronouncement as though it was already a rule. In your packet, and I'd like you to refer to a House research short subject on the rulemaking process for adopting rules. This was authored by Mark Shepard, nonpartisan research and legal counsel for the Government of Operations. This, ladies and gentlemen, is already the current process for adopting rules. I want to make it clear that this bill is not about punishing the Minnesota Department of Education or the Commissioner of Education. It's about better transparency of current law and raising the awareness of a good government procedure we already have in statute. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do believe we have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Debke, Superintendent Sesker, and Superintendent Peterson. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen, and Superintendent Sesker, if you'd say your name for the record, please, and begin.
Yeah, my name is Todd Sesker. I'm Superintendent of Faribault Public Schools, and thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing us to talk about this. I am here to support this bill. I do want to let you know that last evening I was in a four-hour meeting where we're cutting approximately $1.3 million in our budget, and those reductions included administration, clerical staff, teachers, and case facilitators. We have struggled with federal and state mandates to not only support them with staff, but also to support them financially. And in our district, speaking for our district, I guess we do not need another requirement that's not necessarily either legislated or rules on us. I guess I would encourage members to support this bill to prevent more mandate types of things that happen into our district.
Thank you, Superintendent. Superintendent Peterson. Please say your name for the record. And begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of Schools in Minnetonka. And I, too, am here to speak on behalf of this bill, 2596. I think we have, as you know, we have very extensive laws and rules covering special education in particular at the federal level as well as at the state level. And one of the things that makes it even more challenging for our administrators in special education is that we often find at the department level even interpretations or assertions, directives, and so forth that are made beyond what the rules and laws provide. And that's, as I say, in a framework that already has lots of rules and laws to follow. For example, in the complaint process, a parent can appeal to MDE if they feel like the IEP is not being followed or if their rights are not being adhered to. And the complaint is reviewed by MDE, and then they hand down their decision. And they also determine what the consequences are going to be for that decision. And in many cases, special ed directors and other staff believe that the department has exceeded the rules and laws that are governing this area. And so there's a lot of concern about the chances districts take when they make some decisions, trying to be part of the overall decision-making and enforcement structure. And then beyond that, those kinds of decisions are treated as precedent. So then they build on their own decisions and their own pronouncements. And we believe that that creates another whole structure of rules, if you will, beyond the rules. In the whole area of monitoring our special ed programs, which is done for all districts about every five years, and there's been a lot of concern among special ed folks from the last round of such monitoring or audits that the corrective plans and the corrective actions expected were well beyond state and federal rules and regulations. The MDE has tried to promulgate a rule that students who no longer meet the eligibility qualifications for being disabled could continue receiving special education services if there was a continuing need. Well, it's almost always possible to build a case for a continuing need if a student has had services up to that point. So that's really, it's difficult for districts to help that student move on and become part of society. Another example is in terms of the paperwork requirements. As you know from talking to special education directors and teachers, there's an enormous amount of paperwork that has to be done around IEPs and enforcing the special ed laws. And here's another area where special ed folks have seen an increase in the breadth of these kinds of directives, and so enhancing even further the need for more paperwork. And finally, I would cite in the area of the Medical Assistance Fund billing that for years we were able to use our intermediates or cooperatives to help us collect on students. And MDE has just recently ruled that intermediates can no longer collect and report for an independent school district. So that passes that responsibility back to all of the local districts. So I would encourage you to consider passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Are there those who would like to, others who would like to testify in support of this provision? Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here today representing both C and I also do legislative work for the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. I'm very familiar with this bill that was introduced a few years ago, and then Commissioner Alice Segrin said, "You're trying to kill a mouse with a machine gun," I think is what was the line that she used. This is not about mice or machine guns or commissioners or anything like that. This is a transparency bill, and I think that one of the things that, as I've watched over the years, it's incumbent on the legislature to write clear laws, and it's incumbent on the department when those laws aren't clear to come back and say, what did you mean? I know that Representative Depke is putting intense statements in a lot of her bills, and is I think in some folks say, well, why are you doing that? Well, I think it clarifies what direction the legislature is trying to go on certain bills. And when that is not clear, I think there are times when the Department of Education and sometimes goes in a direction that probably they should come back and consult. And it's not only the Department of Education. I've worked on pupil transportation issues as well, and we've had our wrestling matches with DPS on many of the same things. But I think it's greater transparency, it's good government, it's just a way to have that conversation between the administrative and executive branches work more in tandem, and so we certainly support that, and echo much of what Dr. Peterson and Dr. Sesker have said regarding the need for greater clarity. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lundell. Are there others in support? If not, are there those with concerns? And we'll welcome the department. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education. The Department of Education does oppose this bill for three reasons. First, it is redundant, yet it's incomplete. It secondly strips away executive authority in violation of Article 3, Section 1 of the Minnesota Constitution. And it adds confusion because it conflicts with another agency process which is already in place. The proposed bill is duplicative of the existing statute, the Administrative Procedures Act, which can be found in Minnesota Statutes 14.381. However, this bill does omit the portion of that law that that section of statute that states an agent, quote, an agency or determination is not considered an unadopted rule when the agency enforces a law or rule by applying the law or rule to specific facts on a case-by-case basis. Under the current statute, any person may petition the Office of Administrative Hearings already if an agency enforces a pronouncement, if an agency enforces a pronouncement as though it were a duly adopted rule. And such a petition is supported by affidavits and served upon the agency. And then an OAH administrative law judge has the statutory authority to determine whether or not a pronouncement is being enforced as an unadopted rule. The proposed bill is unnecessary because a remedy already exists in law to address the concerns that have been raised. Secondly, the proposed bill is untenable because one of the main functions of the department is to ensure that both state and federal requirements and statutes are being enforced. The proposed bill ties the department's hands in terms of executing its authority and offering clarification and providing guidance to the field. The Minnesota Constitution states that the governor must, quote, take care that laws be faithfully executed, end quote. The powers of the executive are carried out by executive agencies. And although the proposed bill does not forbid the commissioner from issuing pronouncements, the disclaimer required under the bill appears to be an attempt to legislate away the department's authority to interpret and enforce the law. And we all know that no matter how well a law is written, there are unintended consequences that can arise, and there are unanticipated scenarios. And the department's role is to interpret the existing law and rule to address those unanticipated scenarios. The Office of Administrative Hearings was established to provide a fair and prompt and impartial hearing process for citizens who disagree with actions taken by administrative agencies. One of the three main areas of OAH authority is to hear and decide cases regarding the APA, state agency contested cases, and rulemaking hearings. The proposed bill violates the doctrine of the separation of powers under Minnesota Constitution Article 3, Section 1 by stripping that power from the executive and delegating it. Finally, the department, when we do exercise pronouncements, we do use that authority very cautiously. This is evidenced by very few pronouncements that are made and that are issued, and such pronouncements are proper use of executive agency authority, and they do serve to prevent litigation and reduce costs by preventing disputes from escalating. So with that, I just reiterate that the department does not support this bill, and I would stand for questions.
So, Mr. Corte, don't you think a disclaimer, though, is good policy coming from your department in regard to the many memos, bulletins that you send out? Is not a disclaimer in order?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think the problem with the disclaimer is that it's asking the department to prospectively make a determination about whether a pronouncement is, in fact, you know, if we're acting as it's an unadopted rule. This isn't the position of the department. The position of the department is to offer this pronouncement, and if the pronouncement is deemed by the Office of Administrative Hearings as that we're acting as if it's an unadopted rule, then they make that determination. By having the department issue, by putting this disclaimer, it's effectively saying that it's already an unadopted rule, and therefore this pronouncement would be unenforceable.
So, Mr. Corte, does the department or has the department sent numerous memos in regard to special education? I'll use the prone restraint as an example since the administration changed.
Madam Chair, as in the previous administration and the current administration, we receive a number of requests from school districts on a daily basis about how their specific situation is to be interpreted under current law. And when those situations arise, our compliance and monitoring department, when it comes to special education or our special education department, will take a look at the facts and how on the case-by-case basis and how they align under the current rule and the current statute, and issue our findings based upon that.
And Mr. Corte, do you believe that your memos are specific enough so that those who receive the memo understand what is being said in regard to the particular issue? Because the complaints that come to me suggest that you send out a memo, there's an interpretation of a rule or a law, but then the district understands it differently. So, you know, language can be a huge player in how interpretation occurs, whether it's on your side or their side. And I think Representative Depke has brought forth this provision because we feel a frustration going on, especially in the area of special education, when it comes to what does this rule or this law mean for practical purposes. And we're putting that huge responsibility on our teachers and our special education directors. I hear numerous concerns coming from them about they're still not clear about what you're saying to them.
Madam Chair, it's definitely the intention of the department to be as clear as possible when we issue these pronouncements. And if that's not being done in a manner, we're definitely hearing if that's not being done in a manner that's satisfactory to districts, then that's something that we definitely take very seriously and make every attempt to clarify any pronouncement that we would make. However, as stated before, sometimes the law is ambiguous when it comes to certain situations, and it's the position of the department in that situation to interpret and enforce the law as we see fit. And by issuing this disclaimer ahead of time, it really kind of takes away any of the pronouncement authority that would exist but by making a pronouncement.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an interesting discussion for me. Mr. Corte, when you said that, first of all, that this was duplicative, meaning that it already was in statute, we didn't have to do this, and then in the second breath you said it's also untenable. Are you suggesting that the current language is also untenable for the commissioner and for the department?
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, no. The portion that was untenable is the disclaimer portion, because by having the disclaimer put in, then it's kind of tying the agency's hands, as I mentioned, in terms of executing our authority and clarifying and providing guidance to the field. It wasn't in regards to the current remedy that exists under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Representative Woodard.
And just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you think of all the stakeholders within our K-12 education system that are kind of saying the system isn't working for them, that the pronouncements aren't really working, have you worked with those groups to kind of allay some of the concerns that we've talked about here in committee?
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodard, absolutely. It has been the motivation of the department under this new administration, under the commissioner, to move from a compliance and monitoring only kind of department to a providing support department. We understand that, you know, obviously we have to enforce the statutes and make sure that we're complying with federal regulations, but ultimately our goal is to help school districts out when they have questions. And so, yes, definitely when that happens, we're working with the stakeholders to determine what the best course of action is. I mean, sometimes it's not going to be something that makes everybody happy. We understand that resources are scarce, but if we issue a pronouncement that we feel is saying that this a district or a school has to abide by existing law, then we feel that that's our job as the executive agency to do that.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Corte. And for anyone who's a new legislator, which we do have some on this committee, I will just inform everybody that I've been a co-author and supporter of this bill back when it was Representative Faust. We had Democrats in the in the majority and Republicans in the administration. So my comments are purely academic and from my perspective, regardless of any administration or anything like that. As Mr. Lundell said, I was told I was out of the room. Commissioner Segrin didn't support this change either. But I strongly do, and I bring with it the history of my first assignment as a freshman way back when Representative Kahn let me be the chair of the administrative rulemaking subcommittee or something like that. And so I became, it wasn't anything I chose, but I became interested in rules. Anything that you ever have any knowledge of, it becomes more interesting than you thought. And so I'm of the strong opinion, and I think this is borne out nationally by those who deal with rules, and Representative Kahn and I actually went to a national conference back when we had budgets for those things on administrative rulemaking. And rules are just supposed to support and clarify state statutes, but the agencies do not have the ability to make laws. And so they should not be issuing pronouncements. I don't know where that word came from. It's a new one on me. But they should not be issuing pronouncements that go beyond the law. If the law is ambiguous, then they need to come back the next year with suggestions to clarify the law and have that be in their administrative bill and make sure that where the law fails, that it gets improved. But as far as rules go, they should always be have some law ahead of them that can be cited. Here's what we're clarifying. Here's the guidelines that go with these laws, and they should go through the administrative rulemaking process. And if they don't, then they do not have the force and effect of law. And so I think this bill is just, you know, stating what should be common sense and the obvious. And often school districts, especially ones that don't have huge administrative staffs, don't really know what went through the rulemaking process and what is just coming from the department to be helpful. And so I don't see that there's anything nefarious or terrible about when departments issue guidelines that they put on it. This is not a rule. This is a clarification. This is a guideline, and then it doesn't have the force and effect of law. And if the department wants it to have the force and effect of law, and we could debate that, and we might come down on different sides of that, but if they want it to have the force and effect of law, then they need to get rulemaking authority to clarify and have the rule go through the APA process and be a real rule, or have the legislature do it in statute. So I don't think anyone should be threatened by this unless agencies are taking the law in their own hands and making laws, which should be our job, not theirs.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask a question, but I won't. I think Representative Greiling did a terrifically wonderful, concise job of identifying the issue at hand here. And I do think, though, I'll only add this to her comments, that I think that all of this then begs a bigger question for all of us here in the legislature, that when we do pass laws, that we try awfully hard not to have them be ambiguous. Now, I know that's easier said than done. I get that, and I do appreciate where the department is at in terms of trying to wrestle through some pretty complex policy directives, and quite frankly, policy directives that often will cross over with federal directives, and that's certainly the case with our special ed, and that's where this issue has arisen. And it may well be that the bill might require a little bit of, you know, sort of technical, pieces here to make sure that the department, we're not doing anything where we're setting up the department for some kind of legal challenges that would arise from school districts for lack of being good guiders. I mean, you would hate to have that swing in that way as well. But I think it is, I think Representative Greiling captured it best, that you know, this is really an exercise of us as a legislative branch jealously guarding the authority entrusted to us by the people, that we're the only body that can pass laws. And it is going to produce, you know, kind of these possible messy outcomes out in the greater public. But again, then the pressure really is on us to be as clear as possible when we legislate.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. It's good to have the wisdom of you and Representative Greiling. Representative Greiling, I do remember when I worked with Representative Kahn on government operations, how great she was in getting into rules, and I loved it. And then I know you were part of it, so it's good history to know that we've been really alert to what happens. Representative Depke, do you have anyone else in the audience who...
No, no, I do not.
Mr. Heller, if you can be very brief, please come forward. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and address this provision only, please.
My name is Rick Heller. Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity to speak, and members. My name is Richard Heller. I currently unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. I've, as far as if I understand this correctly, the department does review of continuous improvement plans, including complaints, when a complaint is filed by a parent of a kid that perhaps been labeled, which I see, has special needs. Because of complaints are filed and districts are found in specific areas compliant or not, and it appears that they're allowed that flexibility to make those determinations based on federal, state, and rules. And it's my suggestion, perhaps that's why they generate these memos and send them out. I'll give you one example. In 2009, I provided a handout where a district, Bloomington School District, was found out of compliance and not meeting a student that was twice exceptional. In 2009, the department offered exceptional language into statute. However, it hasn't gone anywhere. I think it's important, and you know, the district is found out of compliance and perhaps individuals don't understand who the twice exceptional are, that you might consider putting in a statute. And for a commissioner to have that flexibility to make the determinations, somebody's got to make some calls on what's going on out there in the trenches, and this allows them to make flexibility. However, I do agree with one fact about this. Why isn't it brought up to the Capitol? Why isn't it reinforced and put in rules? And why is it a case-by-case basis, especially when on a national level, the twice exceptional has been identified by the NEA, the National Educational Association, called the Twice Exceptional Limit 2006. I am unable to access stuff yet at the legislature because it's not in a accessible format for me yet. I appreciate it that perhaps you can make that happen in some sort of scribe way. I like to express myself, not to describe myself. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had an opportunity to speak with Mr. Heller briefly outside the hallway, and he shared something else with me, which I think is also important. It's really about transparency. And so, you know, what you had expressed was, well, you know, do parents get to see these pronouncements? Do we, you know, get to see the memos? Do we know? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's a fair request on the part of citizens.
Thank you very much, Representative Mariani.
Your Chair, if I could speak to that.
Yes, please.
Just recently, the department is now making their training documents, or I say compliant documents for complaints accessible with a PDF, and I appreciate that. They are training documents not just for teachers, administrators, school administrators, et cetera, but also for parents if they choose to be engaged in the process, the very complex process. And frankly, I don't know who has time to dive into that. Yet, if there's going to be they use it for training documents, I've never seen a memo out there for inviting parents to go to the trainings. It's almost like we'll train the educators, but parents are on their own. I think that really the true watchdogs are the parents, especially when you got the kids that are still learning to be engaged in reading, perhaps even using a screen reader if they choose to, or even knew that they were available. Currently, districts are reading books to kids in high school now, in substitute of screen readers, as you know. So anyhow, transparency is always a nice word, but until you apply it, I don't know, frankly, what that means up here. It seems like this is an informational place, but would be helpful to put application in the what, not just the how. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, and I hope the department was hearing your concerns, and they're affirming that, so thank you very much. Mr. Benson, did you have Representative Benson, did you have a question for Mr. Heller?
No, not
for
him.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just quickly listening to this discussion, I support the bill, of course, but just to speak for the department a little bit, although they probably don't need me to do it. Lots of times legislation is passed here which is not very clear because the legislators are generalists and they are not experts in the area, and so they can overlook things. And also, in order to pass legislation, sometimes it's necessary to make compromises and leave things very ambiguous. So I just want to, you know, call out to the administration and the difficulty that departments many times have with this legislation. So clarification is the responsibility as well as legislation for those of us who vote on these things. But I just wondering, maybe someone from the department could answer this. When they do issue a clarification to a district, and it turns out that it's not a rule, but the but the district may assume that it is, does it open school districts to any legal consequences? That is, they will make a decision which they assume is a rule by the department based on law, and then find out that they've overstepped in some way. And so then are they open, and have there been examples of them being open to litigation?
Mr. Carte.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I'm not aware of any specific instances, although I haven't been at the department that long, admittedly, so there definitely could be some. I think that the pronouncements are only used when there's ambiguity in the rule or the law as it exists. And what we're doing is putting forth clarification in those pronouncements about how we interpret and how we're enforcing existing law. So I would imagine, and this is just a guess, that, you know, if the school district was acting on a pronouncement that we put forth, then that would probably be covered under saying, oh, this was our fair interpretation of the law as the department relayed to us.
You know, members, that's why committee hearings are so important, and that they're recorded, because it is incumbent upon the administration, the executive branch, to listen to our discussions and our debates to understand what our intentions are and clarifications that we make. So this has been very good this morning, and I'm sure that this meeting probably will be listened to by concerned parties. Representative Benson, did you have any further follow-up?
No, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carte. As usual, Mr. McHenry and Mr. Carte were here early this morning, and I really appreciate their coming in to share the concerns from the Department of Education. Representative Depke, closing comments.
Yes, thank you very much, and I appreciate the spirited discussion. I appreciate the comments by the Department of Education. I want to reemphasize that this is not about punishing the Minnesota Department of Education or the Commissioner of Education. The department has indicated that that the law is redundant and that it strips away their authoritative powers, and I want to reiterate that their authoritative powers have already been very clearly identified in the Administrative Procedure Act, also known as the APA, in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 14. It talks specifically about a rule is an agency statement of general applicability and future effect and made to implement law. In an agency must follow the APA rulemaking procedures, and in addition to obtaining, an agency must solicit comments from the public on the subject matter of possible rules at least 60 days before publishing a notice of the proposed rules. This is already in law, folks. We are not doing anything here to punish anyone. We are clarifying what's already in statute. And I would appreciate a yes vote on this. I'd like to pass it on to Education Finance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Depke. With that, I'll renew your motion that House File 2596 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Members, on Thursday, we'll lead off with Representative Dabney's prone restraint, and then we'll have mayoral control and the parent petition. It is likely that we'll have to continue Thursday evening, so please check your schedules and be ready for that. With that, members, meeting adjourned.